Welcome back to Issues Etc., talking about a possible Fred Thompson run for presidency in 2008. Roland writes this from St. Louis. He says his strong suit is not having to do the "I used to believe that, but now I believe this" shuffle. He's been publicly consistent in his expression of his views on life, guns, taxes, and other things, and that's from where he draws his strong appeal. My vote for the candidate to interview, writes Roland, is Pat Paulson. I think he's dead, Roland, but nice try. Yes, I do remember laughing. And, Roland, you're such a boomer. That's just Pat Paulson. Who else? Pat Paulson was the... Who is the guy who runs now, kind of like Pat Paulson? There's someone out there who... It's a comedian. Although I never could figure out if Pat Paulson was a comedian, because I never found him particularly funny. Thanks for the email, Roland. All right, so there's an appeal there. Roland has his list of why Fred Thompson appeals to him. We do need to clarify something a caller said before the break in the last segment of Audio Open Lines, and that is a caller said, well, she had heard that Fred Thompson is pro-life but is against repealing Roe v. Wade. His most recent appearance on Meet the Press, at least according to the bullet point summary of Thompson on the issues, he is pro-life, believes federal judges should overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade abortion rights decision as, quote, and this is Thompson's quote, bad law and bad medical science. So he does believe in overturning Roe v. Wade, at least as late as his last appearance on Meet the Press. He's opposed to gay marriage but would let the states decide whether or not to allow civil unions. Quote, marriage is between a man and a woman, and I don't believe judges ought to come along and change that. Those are the issues that matter to most of the voters. When it comes to someone like Fred Thompson possibly throwing his hat into the ring, what matters to you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If we could have any presidential candidate at this point on the program to ask questions, who would it be? Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. And again, our call-in number is 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Pope Benedict, I think this is what a lot of people feared when he was elected pope, that he was going to become the enforcer. When I hear a news story like this from NBC, I can only applaud what Pope Benedict seems to want for worldwide Roman Catholicism.
He leads a flock of more than 1 billion Catholics worldwide, Pope Benedict XVI. There is no denying that he's very different from his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, and today the man who was once called God's Rottweiler is putting some teeth into the Church's teachings. NBC's Ned Colt explains.
He's the Pope who's going back to basics. Over the weekend, Pope Benedict warned Catholics that hell does exist and is eternal. He says no to gay marriage and condom use. And earlier this month, he reaffirmed celibacy in the all-male priesthood, calling it a priceless treasure. He's widely considered one of the most conservative popes in generations. So no surprise that he's pushing the basic tenets of the Church. His message:
this is where the Church stands, and this is how you can be a Catholic.
He's even weighed in on sharing a stage with rock stars. Fine for the charismatic John Paul, but in his new book, the then cardinal didn't think twice about trying to stop Bob Dylan from performing before Pope John Paul.
He would have seen it as sort of vulgar and almost embarrassing. And this is the difference between John Paul II, the star quality pope, and Pope Benedict XVI, the quiet, scholastical German.
The current pope has claimed rock music is the work of Satan. Pope Benedict's preferred music, Gregorian chants, and he wants to bring Latin back to Holy Mass.
In less than 2 years as leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Benedict has made very clear his vision for the future, emphasizing tradition in both church doctrine and values.
The message is no different from John Paul's.
You are a great showman as well as a great holy man.
The difference, the method.
Pope Benedict is a much more staid figure, much more solemn, and I think that we're speaking about more a question of style here than we are of doctrine.
Just 2 years into his papacy, Benedict has chosen his own path, a no-frills approach to promoting the core beliefs of the Church. For today, Ned Colt, NBC News, London.
All right, now don't get me wrong. What I applaud here in Benedict's, the tenor that he has taken among Roman Catholics is not the specifics of his, although I do agree with many of the specifics of what he teaches. There's no doubt about that. I mean, so do you. He says gay marriage is wrong. You believe that too, don't you? Yeah, so there you agree. There are many places where we disagree. But what I applaud here is his willingness to be what he is, a Roman Catholic, and to urge his fellow Roman Catholics to be what they are without making apologies. Without saying, well, yeah, we're Roman Catholic, but and we're sorry for that. We really apologize, sincerely apologize, and we don't believe most of what our church teaches. So please, that's what you find in so many other churches. Would that more leaders in the church would be unapologetic and unashamed of their church's positions? That's what I applaud in Benedict. He is unashamed of his church's positions. He is willing to promulgate them, and he is willing to encourage everyone who claims to be a Roman Catholic to believe them. Like I've said many times here, if you're going to be a Roman Catholic, we're going to disagree on a lot of things, but if you're going to be a Roman Catholic, be the best Roman Catholic you can be. Then at least I know where you stand. If you're one of these cafeteria Catholics where you choose this and choose that, I have no way of understanding or dealing with it. If you're going to be a Calvinist, be the best one you can be. If you're going to be you name it, be the best one you can be. Then we can actually deal with one another based upon something objective rather than on what you personally interpret your Roman Catholicism to mean to you. It's Audio Open Lines Issues, etc. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, the 28th of March. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Many expected this from Benedict, and now that he's delivering upon it, no one can say they're surprised. Benedict, he was, what was he known as, the Rottweiler or something like that when he was Cardinal Ratzinger? He was the head of the Congregation for the Faith, the doctrinal arm of the Vatican. And a scholar in his own right is able to say, okay, this is what we believe and this is what we don't believe. He expects Roman Catholics to believe it. And as much admiration as one might have for Pope John Paul II, he had glimmers of that, but it wasn't as strong as it could be. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Kathy in St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, this is one of my, I guess, pet peeves is that people, whatever they are, it seems like when, particularly if they're denominational, they're just not very good at what their church, you know, teaches. I mean, they don't believe it. They don't. They say, I'm a Baptist, but I think you can drink. I'm a Baptist, but I think you can live together. I'm a Lutheran, but I believe in decision theology. I mean, you know, where in life do we do things so halfway, except in church? And it seems like the things that have the most importance of eternal significance, and you know, are the things that we are the loosest and most careless about. And I think it's a crying shame. And what does it say about us?
Kathy, thank you very much. She just gave us a soundbite of the week. I don't know if we're playing soundbite of the week tomorrow, but if we are, Kathy's in there for sure. Right. In what other realm of your life do you say consistently, I'm blank, but? You don't do it in your marriage. Honey, I'm your husband, but we don't. We have unqualified devotion and commitment to so many things in our lives. Well, let's just pull it into the political realm for a second. What would you make of a Republican who said, well, I'm a Republican, but, and then started going through the Republican platform, registering their dissent with this, that, and the other thing? You'd say, at the end of the conversation, you might say, well, you're not much of a Republican. You might be a Republican in name only. Substitute Democrat, whatever you want for that. What would you make of a presidential candidate who says, I'm running for the candidacy, a Republican ticket for the presidency in 2008, But let me tell you where I disagree with virtually all Republicans on this issue and that issue. You'd say, probably not the guy you want to be voting for. If you're a Republican or if you're a Democrat, the same thing goes, right? Why is it that in the realm of theology, Christians who can see through that kind of nonsense in the political realm very easily adopt it? And the things, as Kathy said, that matter most, we play the loosest and the fastest with. Here's a BBC report, staying on Catholic issues, about the late Pope, John Paul II, and what has got to be one of the fastest tracks to sainthood ever.
Pope John Paul's legacy as the former leader of the Roman Catholic faith could soon be secured for eternity in the minds of the faithful with the help of a sainthood. The Vatican says it has finished piecing together the evidence to turn Pope John Paul into a saint. But to qualify, the late pontiff must first be beatified. In other words, the Church must first prove he performed at least one miracle during his lifetime. At a news conference in Rome, Vatican officials said they hoped to do just that with the help of a French nun. They told reporters the nun, who was suffering from Parkinson's disease, was cured overnight by praying to the Holy Father.
It will be the duty to the Church to say if we have or not the miracle. Now we can talk about the grace that this nun received by the intercession of the Holy Father.
The identity of the nun remains a closely guarded secret. The Church says her handwriting on the eve of her cure was illegible due to her illness. But after the miracle had happened, her handwriting apparently became legible again. Whatever the outcome of the beatification process, many in Pope John Paul's native Poland say he doesn't need to prove himself.
For me, he is already a saint since he is in heaven, and during his life served as such an example of sainthood. It's up to the Church. I cannot say anything more.
During the Pope's funeral mass 2 years ago, there were already widespread calls to fast-track him to sainthood. His successor, Pope Benedict, is under great pressure to please the many voices calling for his elevation to sainthood. Greg Mosbach, BBC News.
I can't remember. We were talking about this off the mic. Was Mother Teresa beatified recently? And she wasn't canonized. She wasn't declared a full saint. I'm pretty sure of that. But I think she was beatified. And at the time, they were like, wow, things are happening very quickly here. John Paul has been dead how long? Not 2 years, I don't think.
2 years, 2005.
Yeah, 2005 is when he died. Mm-hmm. And they're already well on their way in the process toward beatification and then canonization. It used to take, you know, in some cases, it would take centuries. Of course, we live in a 24-hour soundbite, very short attention span culture. Makes saints faster. Herman calls from Illinois. Hi, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Regarding the direction of Pope Benedict and his predecessor on the issue of evolution, I believe both of them made the statement that it's just more than a theory. They seem to be very approving of it. And what's surprising, the present Pope should be aware, as scholarly as he is, that there is certainly a growing body of scientific objections to the theory of evolution. And this is certainly a puzzling question.
Thank you very much, Herman. I think you're probably right. I know that in the case of John Paul II, there's no doubt that when he was, during his pontificate, they issued the Catholic Catechism in 1995. And it's quite clear in there that Roman Catholics are free to believe in a six-day creation, a literal six-day creation, if they wish. Another option for them is what's called theistic evolution. That is, God is still the creator, but he does it by means of the evolutionary process. Now, the difference between theistic evolution and Darwinian evolution is just the difference between whether you have God guiding evolution or evolution in an unguided random process. So God merely guides what Darwin says happened. And I don't expect that then Cardinal Ratzinger or present day Pope Benedict XVI has changed anything on that. it doesn't make any difference whether it's Darwinian evolution, the godless form of evolution, or theistic evolution that tries to shoehorn God into evolution. You know, what they really ought to be worried about is not so much the scientific questions about evolution. They should be worried about the theological questions regarding evolution. These are not unintelligent people. I would wonder why Pope Benedict XVI has not made the connection between if evolution, which is an engine that runs on death, if evolution is the means by which God created everything, then what's Jesus doing on the cross? If death did not come from man's fall into sin, and then that death subjected the entire creation to what Paul calls futility, and if the curse is not part and parcel of death, then Jesus, if death is actually the mechanism by which God created the world, then Jesus dying on the cross to overcome the curse becomes nonsense. You have to ask, if even theistic evolution is true, what is Jesus hanging dead on the cross for? It could be just survival of the fittest. Back to the phones. Here's Josh in Edmondson. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Todd. I was looking in my Bible to find the part that tells me about the fast track to canonization, and I was wondering if you could help me find where the Bible talks about the fast track.
Yeah, it's called baptism.
Okay.
That's the fast track to sainthood.
Oh, that clears it up. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Josh. Good question. Paul considers those who are baptized into Christ and therefore into his death and his resurrection to be saints, both here below and there above. So if there is a fast track to sainthood, it's baptism. Being united with Christ in his death and his resurrection makes saints. Let's stay on the Catholic issue for one more moment. Here's something that we haven't heard about in a long time. In a world where terrorism now means some guy wearing a turban flying a plane into a building, do you remember the day when terrorism was applied to Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland? It's like a flash from the past. But the story apparently is good news from CNN.
Over the last 30 years, if you saw Gerry Adams and Ian Paisley close together, it required some on-screen artistic license, a special effects department to contrive it. This Monday, all that changed. For the first time ever, the representatives of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, and of Ulster's Democratic Unionist Party did sit down together and negotiate. Northern Ireland Secretary Peter Hayne said the pictures of the old enemies together would reverberate around the world.
Today the clouds have lifted and the people can see the future.
Hammer! Hammer! Hammer!
For decades they glowered at each other across a wasteland of violence. Now Mr. Paisley and Mr. Adams have agreed to a power-sharing government in Northern Ireland that will contain both Republicans and Unionists, Catholics and Protestants. Just one hurdle left. It won't be set up until May the 8th, to allow time for Mr. Paisley to convince his unionists that Sinn Féin really is cooperating with the Northern Ireland Police Force, a move Sinn Féin finally agreed to only in January. The politicians hope that May the 8th will now banish forever scenes like these, the bitter street fighting and the murderous sectarianism that killed 3,600 people over 3 decades. The IRA has renounced violence and destroyed its arms. The Protestants' loyalist militias have been disbanded. And Northern Ireland is beginning to enjoy a new era of secure prosperity. The culmination of a 10-year peace process is in sight. Mr. Adams called for a focus on the future.
We've all come a very long way in the process of peacemaking and national reconciliation. We're very conscious of the many people who have suffered. We ought to them to build the best future possible. It's a time for generosity, a time to be mindful of the common good.
Mr. Paisley, for so long the obdurate opponent of power sharing, signalled that he too had now signed up.
I believe that enormous opportunities lie ahead for our province. Devolution has never been an end in itself, but is about making a positive difference to people's lives. I want to make it clear that I am committed to delivering not only for those who voted for the DUP, but for all the people of Northern Ireland.
Why now? Because the British government had threatened to dissolve the newly elected Parliamentary Assembly unless Northern Ireland politicians did sign up to power sharing. This was the deadline. Tony Blair has spent many years pushing for this outcome.
This is a very important day for the people of Northern Ireland, but also for the people and the history of these islands. And in a sense, everything we've done over the last 10 years has been a preparation for this moment.
For many years, Northern Ireland politicians have trooped in and out of the number 10 door behind me. Deals have fallen apart at the last minute, deadlines have slipped. But at long last, they may be on the final lap of securing peace in Northern Ireland. Thanks to the tireless efforts of Tony Blair and his Irish counterpart Bertie Ahern, it seems that alongside the morass of the war in Iraq, Mr. Blair will be able to point to peace in Northern Ireland as part of his political legacy. Robin Oakley, CNN, London.
It almost seems like a more innocent time looking back. Remember when President Bill Clinton, one of the things that he was most concerned about was war-torn Ireland. There was a special envoy for peace there. That was Jack Danforth, wasn't it? Wasn't Jack Danforth sent over there to help iron out some peace? It seems like a very innocent time when that's what terrorism was. That's what, by and large, that's what we considered a war on terrorism was. You were talking about Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland.
I think it was Senator Mitchell, George Mitchell.
Mitchell, that's who it was. Thank you very much. I was seeing the wrong face in my mind. By the way, we're going to begin a 4-part daily series on Roman Catholicism beginning Monday, the 16th of April, with Dr. Martin Noland. It's been such a long time since Marty has been here in the studio. It would be comforting to have him nearby. We're going to be talking about grace, faith, scripture, and Christ alone, the solas of the Lutheran Reformation. We'll talk about the Mass, the papacy, and church-state issues in that 4-part daily series starting the 16th of April with Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute. The subject in those 4 parts, Roman Catholicism. It's audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We recently talked with, what was the name of this guy? It's coming to me, Michael Bagent. We were talking to Michael Bagent, who had written that book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, or co-authored it. We had an interview with him, and near the end of the interview, I asked him, hey, how's that thing going in London, the big trial that you've had with Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, because they accused Dan Brown of plagiarism, stealing their idea from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and making it his own, and making a lot of money off of it with the Da Vinci Code book, and then later the film. Guess what? They've concluded the trial, and when we come back from this break during audio open lines, we'll have a little piece on the verdict there in London in the Dan Brown plagiarism trial. Stay tuned.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
One of the best ways that children learn is through verse and rhyme. Those kind of things stick in their heads. It's also true of the truths of the Christian faith. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March is a children's book set in verse and rhyme by Dandy Daly Mackle. It's called Easter is for Me. It tells the story of Jesus' sacrificial death for sinners and his resurrection from the dead for sinners. It's called Easter is for Me. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. Find out more at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book on our homepage. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask about the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's a children's book called Easter is for Me, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
6 days. What do the scholars say?
Answers with Ken Ham.
a well-known speaker on the authority of the Bible from its very first verse. Many theologians can say that Genesis does not teach 6 literal days of creation, but what do the Hebrew scholars say?
Well, people who reject the 6 literal days can't find any world-class language scholars to back them up. I'd like to quote one famous Hebrew scholar who's very liberal. He doesn't even believe that Genesis is history, yet he insists that the language of Genesis does teach 6 24-hour days. James Barr, who was a Hebrew scholar at Oxford University, was asked specifically about the Hebrew word for day in Genesis 1, and he responded, quote, "As far as I know, there is no professor of Hebrew or Old Testament in any world-class university who does not believe that the writer of Genesis 1 through 11 intended to convey to their readers the idea that creation took place in a series of 6 days, which were the same as the days of 24 hours we now experience." End of quote. Actually, I found that the rejection of 6 literal days ultimately has nothing to do with the language of Scripture, but it has everything to do with popular beliefs outside of Scripture, like billions of years. The meaning of day doesn't require a scholar to understand it. It just requires believing God's word.
To find out more about how evolutionists have made many Christians believe that the book of Genesis may be unreliable, read Ken Ham's free booklet on the 6 days of creation. It's available at AnswersRadio.com.
At AM 850 KFUO, we often receive emails like that recently received by Pastor Mark Hawkinson, host of Jubilation. Ruth Ann writes, "I love to listen to you on Sundays. You play both an awesome and unusual rendition of the God of Abram praise. Can you tell me where I can get that version? I thought it was great." We're thankful for letters like these from our listeners. You'll find a page of addresses on our website at KFUO.org. Let us know how we can serve you at AM 850 KFUO.
Dr. Arthur Just on what a young man will find every summer at Christ Academy at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
It really does put him in touch with, first of all, a community of people here who love the Scriptures, who worship together, who pray together, and who enjoy, have fun, you know, doing theology. There's just a wonderful excitement and passion for the gospel that is expressed by them. But it is a way of a young man to shape his identity as one who is in Christ and to learn the Scriptures and have a real passion for the gospel.
For more information about Christ Academy, June 17th through the 30th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155. Welcome back to Audio Open Lines, Issues, Etc. this Wednesday, March the 28th. Since it is a Wednesday, and this is the season of Lent, many churches are having Wednesday night Lenten services. You going to church tonight? When you get a chance, perhaps when you're shaking your pastor's hand after the service is all over, ask him if he knows of a high school-aged man, young man, in your congregation who might want to explore the possibility of studying for the pastoral ministry at Christ Academy 2007 up at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's a 2-week residential program that they offer every summer for a group of high school-aged men to go to class and go to chapel and get a taste of what it might be like in the future after they're done with their college and everything that they've done to go to the seminary and study for the pastoral ministry. It's called Christ Academy 2007. You can find out more by locating their logo at our website, issuesetc.org. You can call and ask for more information at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their toll-free number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. Well, as promised, here's a quick update on the latest in the Dan Brown plagiarism trial set in London.
Another court victory for novelist Dan Brown. Britain's Court of Appeal has rejected a lawsuit from 2 other authors who claim he stole their ideas for Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code. The authors sued Brown's publisher, Random House. They claim Brown copied from their 1982 nonfiction work, The Holy Blood and The Holy Grail. Both books theorize that Jesus married Mary Magdalene, had a child, and that their bloodline continues. One of the judges said copyright protects an author's work in researching and writing a book, but does not extend to facts, theories, and themes. Brown wasn't a defendant in the case. Last year he testified that he did study the plaintiff's book when he was writing his bestseller, but didn't copy from it. The authors are left with legal bills of about $6 million. Lori Neff, The Associated Press.
Youch. That's not good. Michael Bajan and his co-author had better start selling some books. $6 million. What's the lesson here? Don't sue Dan Brown? Dan Brown can afford better lawyers than you? You can't copyright history? Don't make up history and then claim that someone else stole it from you? That was always my thought on this whole plagiarism thing. These guys come in saying, look, this is what really happened. Jesus married Mary Magdalene, and they had this start of this Merovingian dynasty and blah, blah, blah. They claimed it was true. They claimed it was history. They claimed it was their research, and this is what really occurred. And then you blame someone for stealing your idea? If it's history, you can't copyright history. I can write a novel about how Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and Doris Kearns Goodwin cannot sue me. Because what she recorded in her biography of Lincoln's days is history. Boy, you got to feel, I mean, Michael Bajan, I don't have any sympathy for his views, but you got to feel for a guy who walks out of an almost two-year trial owing $6 million in legal fees. Unless you're Dan Brown, you can't sell enough books to cover that. It's open lines, and the phone lines are open for your reaction to anything you're hearing here during audio open lines issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's another update, this one on the ongoing trial of polygamist Warren Jeffs.
A puzzling moment in a Utah courtroom involving a gaunt, frail-looking polygamist leader, Warren Jeffs. Jeffs, sitting on the left with his lawyers, was stone silent for 8 hours. The court-operated video system did not provide tight images of him, but all of a sudden he popped up and said,
I'm sorry, Mr. Jeffs. You may not, sir.
I need to just take one matter.
Mr. Jeffs, your counsel can take care of matters for you.
It's hard to hear, but Jeffs haltingly said he had a matter he'd like to clear up. We still don't know what it was. He wasn't allowed to talk. But it had been a day of legal defeats for Jeffs as both sides prepare for trial. More than 20 of Jeffs' supporters drove 40 miles from their polygamous community on the Utah-Arizona border to see the man they believe has a direct line to God.
Do you still consider Warren your prophet?
As usual, Jeffs' followers ignored outsiders and a relevant question because of this development. A source on the prosecution side says Jeffs, in jail without bond, was heard saying he's a sinner, not a prophet. The information may have been released to convince followers to stop their hero worship, but it didn't affect these followers, who stood in devotion when Jeffs walked into the court. Jeffs is charged with arranging the marriage of a 14-year-old girl who testified off-camera at a previous hearing about her wedding ceremony with her 19-year-old first cousin.
I honestly just wanted to die because I was so scared.
Jeffs is accused of being an accomplice to rape because the underage girl had sex with an adult man. Jeffs' lawyers told the judge charges should be dismissed, partly because
that Mr. Jeffs was not aware that unconsented sexual relations were taking place between these two.
But the judge denied the request, as well as a request to change the trial location from this small town of St. George, Utah, to more metropolitan Salt Lake City. But the judge did say local media coverage was not fair to Jeffs, and then he might decide to incur delays and expenses and still move the trial if he can't get a fair jury.
And that may well be laid at the feet of those who exceed reasonable press coverage.
In Jeff's windswept hometown of Hilldale, Utah, not much interest in talking either.
Do you still consider Warren Jeffs your prophet? If you don't mind me asking you, ma'am.
And near the town, a makeshift sign put up by supporters, as Jeffs remains in a jail 30 minutes away. Gary Tuchman, CNN, St. George, Utah.
This is weird because, do you remember sometime back on Issues, Etc., we were talking about, I can't remember what the package was called, but it was something like Happy Polygamists. And there were two that came in the short span of a couple of weeks for us as polygamy was all in the news. The Warren Jeff stirred this stuff up. One was of teenage girls. They were being interviewed in a Utah town. And these girls, not yet married, were just honestly, just like teenage girls do, honestly expressing the hope that one day they too will be part of a plural marriage, a polygamist marriage. They really wanted to be married as but one of many wives to one man. Then we heard one more recently of the more kind of respectable polygamists. They're not the Warren Jeffs type of polygamists. They're the ones that live next door to you. They keep it quiet. They're careful. They don't make a big deal about it. Some might call them the HBO Big Love polygamists. The more discreet polygamists. And then you hear the girls, and these are girls. These are not women. The girls who are victims of these plural marriages, these arranged marriages under Warren Jeffs, and what has turned out to be not just statutory rape. That is, well, it still is non-consensual. Legally, a minor child cannot legally give consent. So Warren Jeffs says he was not aware of the fact that there was not non-consensual relations taking place here in these marriages, that he was not only arranging, but if you understand the whole dynamic of what Jeff's hold over this community was, apparently he was mandating these marriages. And he says he wasn't aware that there was non-consensual relations taking place. When a child under a certain age cannot give consent. You know what? I don't want to be too cynical about this, but you know what I'm wondering? I'm wondering whether or not, as a culture, we're going to look at the Warren Jeffs style polygamy and say, well, that is just obviously wrong. One central charismatic leader arranging for the marriages between middle-aged men and teenage girls and taking 75 wives or whatever. We're going to say, no, that's going too far. But we're going to look at the respectable polygamists who live next door, who don't have 25, but maybe just 2 or 3. And they don't live in a compound. They just live next door to us. And they don't cause any trouble, and they pay their taxes. And we're going to say, but that's okay. The yuck factor of the Warren Jeffs style polygamy impacts just about everyone unless your mind is so open that you are no longer able to hold thoughts in it. But when the yuck factor is taken away, the issue of whether or not the wife in the plural marriage is underage is taken away, I don't know that the American public is going to have too much of an objection to polygamy, as long as it's consenting adults. After all, if you allow for gay marriage, why not polygamy? Why not polyandry, where it doesn't make any difference. You may have one or two husbands. You might have one or two wives. You might have any combination of that you want to put together. As long as everyone's consenting adults and no one gets hurt and they pay their taxes and they don't throw wild parties and they don't shoot us when we try and peek through the window. They don't set up compounds out in Utah. I'm not trying to be, I guess I am that cynical. I think probably that kind of polygamy we won't have any problem with. As long as it doesn't turn into the Warren Jeffs kind of polygamy. You think I'm right or wrong? Care to react? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's another update, the latest from ABC News, on the crisis in the Darfur region of the Sudan.
The unfolding disaster in western Sudan, in the region known as Darfur. A military guard there today blocked a team of United Nations officials, including the head of emergency relief, from entering a refugee camp. Hundreds of thousands are dead, millions more displaced. The conflict has spilled into neighboring Chad, where the BBC's Orla Guerin visited one of the camps.
There's no hiding from the sun, no escaping from the wind. It's hard to imagine a worse place on earth. The dispossessed of Darfur are stranded here, in a camp called Ure Kasoni. At 7 a.m., the rush for school. This one camp has 9,000 children bombed and burnt out of their villages in Darfur. At this school, the youngest have no paper or pens. They use the sand for beginners' lessons. In fourth class, we meet Hamdi. At 10 years old, he already knows too much about bloodshed and killing. His dream is to be a doctor one day. After school, Hamdi takes me to his home of the past 3 years. His mother is dead, his father miles away trying to earn money. Hamdi tells me what happened in his village.
The Janjaweed surrounded the village. If someone ran, they were shot. My sister was killed in the village. My grandfather was killed getting water from the well.
This little boy sees his grandfather in his dreams. And now the Janjaweed have arrived in Chad, he has new reasons to be afraid. From the camp, it's a short distance to Darfur. This dry riverbed is the border between Chad and Sudan. We crossed over to meet some of the rebels fighting against the Janjaweed and the government. The rebels were armed and on alert, expecting an attack. Their leader, General Nasruddin, told me they want justice for those like Hamdi, trapped in the camps.
I'm going to fight until the end of my life or until we get a home. We are fighting so the refugees can go back to their villages.
With darkness closing in, the rebels left us. The attack they'd been waiting for came one day later, but they'd made their getaway before the government bombing. Orla Geeran, BBC News, Darfur.
You can't let something like that go by without talking about, just answering the basic question, why Christians should care about this. It's a long ways away. We're talking about a population that's, it's not exclusively Christian. There are Muslims who have fled to Darfur too. It seems an intractable military conflict. I look at a story like this and I say to myself, I'm completely confused. I don't know enough about what's going on over there to even understand the situation. You know what? You really don't have to. All you really need to know about that situation is there are people in need. We're going to be talking later in the week on Friday about vocation with Dr. Stephen Hine. And one of the things that he mentions in our excellent conversation with him is God takes care of us, not so that we might revel in this, but so that we might take care of others. That's what LCMS World Relief is all about. I doubt they understand the politics of Darfur and the Sudan any better than I do. But they do know that there are people in need, and they're ready to meet that need. When you go home tonight, remember Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. You can find them by going to our webpage, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by calling 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Now, I do have to mention one thing, because earlier this week, I believe, we were talking about The Secret. And one of the advocates for The Secret was asked point blank about Darfur. Now, you guys didn't get to see the video. It looks like a cat box over there. And these are people, they're sitting out there in the sun. There's nothing. There are no trees. They're sitting in the sun. There's no food. There's no nothing. Darfur is not, it's called a refugee camp. These things are called refugee camps. You would not recognize it as a refugee camp. And this guy who was pushing The Secret, this Oprah Winfrey endorsed book on how all you got to do is think it and the universe will deliver it to you. If you think about it and set your attention upon it and your intention upon it, then the universe will deliver it to you. He actually said that a starving boy in Darfur, he could teach that starving boy in Darfur how to, using The Secret, put food on his table. Actually, he should probably teach the boy how to get the table first, because he doesn't even have a table. these are the kind of solutions that someone who would buy into something like The Secret would actually accept? Well, all we need to do is send them the books. All we need to do is teach them how to exercise The Secret. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. After all, they say that The Secret works every time for every person. Steve calls from his car. Hi, Steve.
You know, you beat me to the punch, but you're talking about The Secret. You have to listen to that the other day. And it's basically The Secret. All it is it's just Eastern religion repackaged. Because it's all about, karma. And what you do affects what happens. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of Christians who believe that, who say, well, if you do good things, God will be good to you. And so, well, people in these bad situations, they must have done something bad, as opposed to saying, hey, this is a bad situation. And what did Christ say? Christ said, those are our neighbors. And we should be asking who our neighbor is. We should just be going.
Steve, thank you very much. Good thoughts. Right. I would say this. I don't know if I'd call The Secret Eastern religion, because I don't think it even rises to that level. It is man's basic superstition with God excluded. Now, this is man's basic religion. You probably heard me say this before. The inbred fallen religion of man is superstition, not atheism. Some people think that fallen man is somehow naturally atheistic, doesn't know or doesn't care that there is a God. That's not true. The problem is not, I think this, I got this from Hal Sinkbeil. The problem with fallen man is not that he's godless. It's that he's got every God there is except the true God. And the natural religion of man boils down to superstition. What is superstition? It's very simple. Superstition works like this. Superstition that includes God, to begin with. A lot of Christians actually believe this, sad to say. And here's where you're right, Steve. They believe there is God passively sitting in heaven or wherever God is. And by my actions or my inaction, I manipulate God into doing things for me. He watches what I do, and I am the cause, and God brings the effect. That's superstition. I know that you think superstition has to do with voodoo and pentagrams, and that's not what superstition is. Superstition is the belief that your actions or your failure to act affects the course of your life in some sort of supernatural way. There are a lot of Christians for whom that is the essence of their so-called Christianity. They think they're there to manipulate God. They wouldn't call it manipulate God, but that's in effect what it is, to manipulate God by either doing good things or saying good things to God or refraining from doing bad things, and that will ensure that God will do his part. It's superstition. All The Secret is the same thing with God taken out of the equation. So the advocates of The Secret will talk about the universe rather than God. And I don't know if they're thinking about the universe as God or if they've even thought it through that much. The fact remains that what they have is superstition. The course of my life, my future, depends on what I do or don't do. And in the case of The Secret advocates, they're pretty upfront about it. I think they would even use the word manipulate. You can manipulate the forces of the universe, the law of attraction, the universe itself, to bring good things to you, to drive bad things far away from you. It's just superstition. It may be a little more subtle, a little more sophisticated than someone who thinks that if they step on a crack, their mother's back will break, but it's only a matter of degree. Still have a few minutes left in audio open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This is an email from James in Union. He says, Pastor, it seems to me that the gap between the haves and the have-nots is getting wider. I vote for candidates who are more socially minded, but unfortunately those candidates are too liberal on other issues, abortion and homosexuality, among them. Thank you very much, James. See, this is the dilemma that a lot of people are facing. He's hearkening back to our earlier part of our conversation when we were talking about Fred Thompson and the possibility of his run for the presidency. It's a dilemma a lot of people find themselves in. We had a caller earlier who asked about the economy. He wanted to know if we had any candidate on the program and asked them a question. His question was, what do you think the economy is for? Is it there for itself? Is it an end in itself? Or does it play a role in a larger concern than just making money? Now, he put it in terms of, does it say more about who we are as Americans? I would like to recast that a little bit. Does it say something about who we are as Christians? Speaking as a Christian. It certainly does. And if the gap between the haves and the have-nots is actually getting bigger, as James seems to think it is, a lot of voters are left with that dilemma of, well, you know, the guys who are right on abortion and homosexuality act as though the have-all and end-all of America is strong economic growth and everyone getting theirs. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking with Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief about Job 3:15. It's a very famous passage. Though God slay me, yet I will hope in him. How could Job, or any believer for that matter, say such a thing? We'll find out tomorrow with Pastor Matt Harrison. We'll also continue our series on man's failed attempts to reach God. Mysticism, experience, emotion, one of those false ladders that man constructs to reach God. Dr. Stephen Hine will be our guest. Our weekly series with Deaconess Pam Nielsen on teaching a Sunday school lesson will continue tomorrow, too. We'll be talking about the Lord's Supper. Yes, you can teach children about the Lord's Supper. Deaconess Pam Nielsen will show us how tomorrow on the program. Then Friday, Dr. Stephen Hine on the issue of vocation. God has a place for you in life. You're already in it right now, believe it or not. Where you are right now is where God has put you. And knowing that answers the question, who is my neighbor and what does my neighbor need? We'll talk about it Friday, Sunday night on the program, The Events of Holy Week with Dr. Peter Scair. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.